Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson, and Mr. Barrera as well. I was thinking this morning about how dramatically your job descriptions have changed during this time. And you've done a great job this week. Welcome to council. We had looked forward to being together with you in person, but that was not to be. Maybe soon we can resume assembling in the courthouse. But we're delighted to have you with us. We have four cases today. I plan to take a 5-minute break after the third case, Lennon versus Marriott Ownership Resorts. And then we'll resume to hear the last case. We have committed to allow counsel to have the first 2 minutes of their argument uninterrupted. And so since we've got the clock showing, I think we've done a pretty good job of that this week. Otherwise, I know you're familiar with our traffic light system, and I will enforce it. So with that, I'll call the first case of Elliot Anderson versus the United States.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Michelle Yard and I represent Elliot Anderson. The application of the ACCA enhancement increased the low end of Mr. Anderson's sentence 118 months because the district court relied on the residual clause when it sentenced him. Without the residual clause, the court could not then.
I'm sorry, Ms. Yard. I'm going to ask my colleagues. Are you here, Ms. Yard? Are you able to hear her?
She's a little low, but I turned up my volume on my computer. So.
Okay. All right. I can hear you. I just wanted to be sure everybody had the benefit of your argument. Can we just restart the time on her, Mr. Robinson? Thank you. All right, Ms. Shore, let's take it from the top, if you don't mind.
All right, I'll try and speak up, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The application of the ACCA enhancement to Mr. Anderson's case increased the low end of his guidelines 118 months because the court relied on the residual clause in sentencing him in 2003. Without the residual clause, either then or now, the court could not have imposed the ACCA enhancement. Relative to that enhancement, there's two offenses in issue, battery on a commitment staff and an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. The battery on a commitment staff is a simple battery on a person that's in a protected class. The use of a juvenile adjudication to enhance a sentence requires that the offense involve the use or carry of a firearm, knife, or destructive device. Because the government declined the reliance on the battery in the 2255 proceedings below, I'm going to focus my arguments to begin on the aggravated assault. First, because Florida aggravated assault weapons element is indivisible and has been, review of the Shepherd documents has never been permissible. In the order granting COA, the district court judge that denied the 2255 indicated that he relied on the charging information in finding the firearm to deny Mr. Anderson relief. It was error for the court to engage in fact-finding for an indivisible offense. Second, precedent establishes that now and then the analysis was the same, and juvenile adjudications for aggravated assault did not count as ACCA predicates. Florida aggravated assault's deadly weapons element is broader than the violent felony definition for juveniles, which necessarily requires that the offense use or carry a firearm, knife, or destructive device. The only question in this case is whether there was or wasn't a firearm. Under Florida law, a defendant need only commit an aggravated assault with any deadly weapon, and the type of deadly weapon is not an element. And Florida has case law indicating that nunchucks, brass knuckles, rocks have been deadly weapons under Florida law. The record shows that the district court was not provided any Shepherd documents in 2003, but even if it had been, the government's interpretation of Burge would not historically apply because it hadn't been decided then. That said, the court's review of Shepherd, the charging information to determine the type of weapon was precisely the unconstitutional type of fact finding that's been prohibited since Taylor in 1990. Because of that, we know that more likely than not, the finding would have been the same. Taylor stood for the proposition that ACCA generally prohibits fact finding and demands an elements-based analysis, leaving the court to look only at the fact of conviction and the statutory definition of the offense.
Didn't we say the opposite in Burge? Didn't we say, I guess it's Burge or Burga, didn't we say that you could look at Shepherd documents there? And isn't that what we would have to apply here if we were to reach this issue?
So Burge, I would argue that the court erred by relying on Burge for that ability to look beyond, because Burge was an opinion about divisibility and the modified categorical approach. To use Burge here essentially is to hammer a square peg into a round hole and to say that it fits. The reason for that is that the offense that was being considered in Burge was Alabama burglary, which the opinion states could have been committed one of three ways, which included explosives and some of them deadly weapons and some of them and other things. And the court was trying to determine what offense Burge committed and if it qualified. Anderson's offense was an indivisible elements clause offense. Faced with the divisibility issue, the Alabama burglary and Burge, the Burge court found that the district court may look beyond the fact of conviction.
But counsel, didn't Burge use the look beyond approach not just for the elements clause, which I agree with you goes to the issue of whether there's divisibility, but did so on what I'll call the juvenile clause of ACCA. I don't know that anyone else has called it that, but I will today. On looking at the juvenile clause. And is there any other case law would suggest, let me ask it this way. Is there anything intervening since Burge, which has said that for the juvenile clause, you cannot look beyond? So that's two questions. Didn't Burge say that you could do it with regard to the juvenile clause, not just the elements clause? And second of all, has anything come out intervening which would call that into question?
So I would argue that Burge was misapplied because the offense wasn't divisible. To that, though, you're correct that Burge does say for an offense like the one in Burge, the court can look beyond and essentially make a fact finding. However, my argument is that it's been clear since Taylor that ACCA doesn't allow a fact-focused inquiry.
Well, sir, but Burge is post-Taylor, so that is our reading or gloss on the juvenile clause post-Taylor. I guess after Burge, is there anything else with regard to the juvenile clause which we've said different than Burge?
So, not specifically to the juvenile clause. Taylor does say, though, that its holding apply, or that its discussion applies to the rest of the enhancement statute. And I would argue that Burge, if, to the extent that there's any question, has been abrogated by DeCamp, Mathis, and Shuler.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So a lot of your argument, you got a COA on a Johnson claim, and we know that a Johnson claim is a claim that there's inappropriate reliance on the residual clause. We know a Deschamps, I'm sure we'll all pronounce that differently, but Deschamps is a very different claim. That's a claim going to divisibility and whether you can rely on Shepherd documents or not for a divisible statute. We've said that Deschamps is not retroactive, correct?
Correct.
And in fact, in Beeman, we specifically sort of separated those things out to say, there's the valid claim that you can make and which we've authorized, And then there's the Descamps claim, which is not timely, not successive, not retroactive, which cannot be made, right?
Yes.
Right. So I'm with you on your Johnson claim on the residual stuff, but I'm having trouble getting past all of that to reach this Descamps claim, even if Descamps did abrogate. And then I'll ask follow-up questions on whether it truly did abrogate Burge.
So my argument is, right, that you have to have a Johnson claim to get in the gate, right? So Mr. Anderson alleged that the government filed this notice that it was relying on three offenses for the ACCA enhancement in 2003. One of those offenses included the battery on commitment staff. So he filed this claim stating that it was error because that was a residual clause offense and the court relied on the residual clause. So that gets him right in the gate through essentially Beeman prong one, that the court relied on the residual clause. I have other arguments about that, but in a nutshell, right? Now, his arguments about aggravated assault are essentially to what is Beeman prong two, right? If you have a Johnson claim and you get in the door, now you're looking at, were there three other offenses under the elements clause or the enumerated offenses clause that can still qualify, right? That essentially moot your argument because you still qualify for ACCA. So here the government has said this juvenile aggravated assault. However, it's like the same as if the government hypothetically would have said he has a serious drug offense that qualifies now. If that drug offense was a third degree felony marijuana offense that wouldn't qualify as a serious drug offense, Mr. Anderson, under that second prong of Beeman, still has to be able to come back and say no.
But how in Beeman, though, did we not say, where that exact kind of argument was made, did we not say that that is not necessarily appropriate, the Descamps part of the argument? And then how do we get rid of, or how do we get over Hires, where we specifically said that a Descamps claim that's piggybacked on a Johnson claim, exactly what you're talking about now, is not appropriate and not successive?
It's not a Descamps claim, though, because the court relied on the residual clause in 2003. And for him to now have to explain why there's not three other offenses can't be handicapped by the residual clause. Because if the government had proposed a drug offense that didn't count, he has to come back and be able to say, no, that's a drug offense that doesn't count. That will never be a Johnson claim, right? To say that there's a drug offense that doesn't count isn't a Johnson claim, but it's the same here. To say that the ag assault doesn't count doesn't transform his Johnson claim that got him here into a Descamps claim.
How does Descamps, you would agree, and Mathis dealt with the elements clause and divisibility, correct?
Yes.
How could those possibly abrogate a holding with regard to the juvenile clause, which by its terms, by language, is actually quite different than the elements clause?
So the juvenile clause in 924E2B is subsumed by the act of violent felony definition, right? It's part and parcel. It's not separate.
Yeah, but we've always separated these things out in clauses. There is the residual clause, there is the elements clause, there is the use of violence, or I'm sorry, the specific enumerated offense clause. And then there's the separate clause for juvenile offenses, which use the terms acts of juvenile delinquency involving. So an act involving something, which is not the same language as is used in any of the other clauses that I can tell. So how can we read Descamps, which was specific with regard to the elements clause, as having any holding that would abrogate something regarding the juvenile clause?
So the act of juvenile delinquency is just a term of art, right? The act of juvenile delinquency is just what we call a juvenile crime because we don't call them crimes when they're children. So what the relevant language then after you get past the juvenile crime is, you know, involving the use or carry of a firearm. Descamps tells us that, you know, affirms that—
I have never heard, and I've been doing criminal law for a little bit, of it being described as an act of juvenile delinquency, as any kind of term of art. Why would it not be a finding of juvenile delinquency or a delinquency finding or a juvenile delinquent? But isn't the use of the term act involving indicate something different than a crime, which is the term that's used for the residual clause, for the elements clause? And I know over time, if Judge Martin will allow me to have you answer the question.
course.
Thank you.
So the juvenile conviction is considered a delinquent offense, right? So
it's a finding of delinquency, right?
It's an adjudication of delinquency.
Right, right, not an act.
My contention is that the federal courts use the term act of juvenile delinquency in other statutes, and that is a term of art that we just don't call it a juvenile crime because we don't consider children to be criminals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, while Ms. Taylor approaches, I'm going to go get the sun out of my eyes. All right.
May it please the court, Michelle Taylor for the United States. As the court has recognized, we are here on a successive 2255 that raises a Johnson claim. And a Johnson claim, which challenges the validity of the residual clause, is different than a DeCamps or Mathis claim, which can't be the basis of a successive 2255. And in a Johnson claim, Beeman has now clarified that the defendant has a two-tier burden. The first tier, he has to show that going back to the time of his sentencing, this is as a historical fact, it is more likely than not that the court relied solely on the residual clause and not also or only on one of the other clauses. He also has to show that, you know, going back to that time, he didn't have three other convictions that could have qualified. And the fact that it's a historical analysis perhaps helps with the question about, is this just a backdoor way to raise a DeCamps claim that we already said we couldn't? Because no, you go back to the landscape of sentencing, and at the time of sentencing, could this aggravated assault have been a predicate? And the answer to that is yes. It didn't need to be back then because the defendant never objected to the three convictions that the United States had relied on. But Tribune now teaches us that if a defendant does object to one of the convictions, and there might be questions as to whether it qualifies, the United States is free to rely on other convictions set forth in a defendant's criminal history to then show that the defendant remains subject to the ACCA enhancement. Going to the statutory language, so we shouldn't even end up really getting to what sort of a divisibility question or interesting questions about how we should interpret this juvenile adjudication provision. Because we really have to start with the historical question of whether there was any indication that the defendant was sentenced based on the residual clause at all. And the answer is no. There's nothing in the record that shows that the defendant was sentenced based on the residual clause.
Didn't you waive that argument, though? Didn't you stipulate below that the defendant had met the first step of Beeman in your filings before the district court? You just agreed, I think, that the battery on commitment staff offense was out. Under the Johnson claim, and then you litigated the whole case on what became the second prong of Beeman. So why is it
over? Your Honor, the district court briefing happened before Beeman was decided. And so at the time of the district court briefing, both parties were addressing the question of whether under current law, the defendant would have three qualifying convictions. But Beeman now teaches us that that's a question of history. So going back to the landscape at the time of 2003, is a very different question. Whether the court could have relied on the battery offense in 2003 under the elements clause is a totally different question as to whether under 2020 law that battery offense would be relied on as an ACCA predicate. But I would note that
I don't disagree with you about how Beeman came out after the litigation in this case. I guess my point is, didn't you tell the district court that you weren't relying on the battery on commitment staff offense, you conceded that away, and then you moved on to the assault with the deadly weapon offense, which became step two under Beeman. I'm just having trouble seeing it how we would get back to step one of Beeman, given what you did below.
So I guess I would have two responses. The district court response did not affirmatively say we're not gonna rely on battery, it just said there were three convictions that still qualify. It was using the current language of still qualifying. But the other question is, regardless of what we might have said or didn't say, I think the Tavares case in the 28J letter helps us with that. Beamon is now controlling precedent of what the defendant's burden is. And so the defendant has that burden of showing that he does not have three additional qualifying offenses, whether we were right or wrong in relying on him. He still has to show that under Beamon. And so, you know, that's part, Tribue also shows that that's part of the defendant's burden, not only to show that he was sentenced as a matter of historical fact based on the residual clause, but that also looking back, there weren't three other convictions that could have qualified. But it's interesting, even under today's law, whether a battery offense could have qualified is an open question. I actually just listened to an oral argument yesterday in Miami in the Santos case, and that was going to raise the question of whether Florida battery is divisible in only two ways, or if it's further divisible between the touching and striking issue. And that was sort of the question that the court was going to look at in the Santos case yesterday. So I listened to that argument, but that whole argument ended up being about Beamon. It ended up being, do we even get to that question when the defendant can't show his Beamon burden that he was sentenced based on the residual clause? Because just like this case, that case was before the court on a Johnson claim. So we have to, you know, see this through the Johnson lens, and the Johnson lens requires the defendant to show both that historical fact and that he doesn't have three qualifying convictions. And that's true regardless of if we had said anything at all, if we hadn't filed a response, that's still his burden.
If you're right about that, that it's not waived or you haven't conceded the point and that it has to be done anew as a matter of historical fact, shouldn't the district court make that call and not us? I mean, we were not the sentencing judge. We were not there at the time. We certainly didn't know what went through the head. We don't know what evidence could be presented about what historical fact existed at that time. Isn't that exactly the sort of fact a district court should make in the first instance, and not us in the first instance?
It wouldn't necessarily be unreasonable to let the district court decide that on remand, but I think it would be futile given the state of the record. The defendant has already recognized in his reply.
Your opposing counsel has said, I counted at least three or four times that the district court clearly relied on the residual clause with regard to all of his prior convictions. So it clearly is a contested fact. Why would it be futile?
So in the reply brief at page 11, he recognizes that the district court didn't ever say what clause he relied on. That was because it was never an objection. So we don't know, that certainly the record doesn't have any direct evidence that this was a residual clause sentence. Now, Beamon also contemplated if there's no direct evidence, like a comment by the parties or by the court explaining what clause applies, another way you could satisfy Beamon is sort of a landscape of the law view. And going back to the landscape of the law back in 2003, it was certainly not clear at that point that the defendant could have been sentenced based only on the residual clause. The defendant filed a 28J letter citing a Rozier decision late last night. I tried to pull it up on Westlaw. I couldn't even find it. But then one of my colleagues was able to help me find it through a district court docket somewhere. And that decision doesn't even really say that, like the way in the 28J letter, it says that the court concluded that it didn't categorically qualify under the elements clause. All that decision says, it cites the elements clause, and then it holds that the offense, even by touching, could create a risk of harm. So it speaks in terms of the residual clause, but it certainly doesn't hold that there wasn't an elements clause analysis, that you know, the elements clause wouldn't have applied. And in fact, you know, back at this time, we're talking pre-Johnson, so we don't yet know, this is the 2010 battery by touching Johnson. So we don't know at this point that a battery by touching doesn't require adequate force. And in fact, Johnson, that Supreme Court.
But counsel, where the district court didn't have Beamon, didn't know what finding he or she needed to make. And I believe it's the same, the sentencing judge is the same judge, right? It's the same judge throughout?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So why can't the sentencing judge say, you know what, I remember that day well, that's my wife's 35th birthday, and we had a big blowout that particular day, and I know I was relying on the residual clause for every single one of those. I've seen an order like that out of Miami, for example, where the judge says, I assume residual clause for all of these cases. So how are we to be able to know what's in the district judge's head with regard to that? And why would we make that finding in the first instance, where that could be a finding of the district court?
I think, you know, this court has found, for instance, in the Tavares case that remand would be futile given the state of the record. So at least in some court cases, the court hasn't sent it back. But if this court wanted to give the district court the chance to see if he could recall what happened back in that 2003 sentencing, that would only be that first prong of Beavin. The second prong would still require the defendant to show he had at least three qualifying convictions, and he can't do that either. So we have two of the convictions are non-controversial, the aggravated battery and the robbery.
So your opposing counsel says, A, this isn't really a Burge case because Burge dealt with a divisible statute and this isn't divisible. And B, and I'm trying to summarize Ms. Yard's argument, and she can tell me if I have it wrong, but B, Burge has been abrogated by Deschamps. So address those as to why we cannot rely on the ag assault here.
So Burge remains controlling precedent. Burge is actually very similar to the case we have here because the Georgia statute in Burge just said deadly weapon. It didn't say firearm use. So in order to get beyond what kind of deadly weapon it was, just like here, the court had to consult the Shepherd documents. And the court was interpreting specifically this juvenile provision, which is different than the other clauses we often deal with under the ACCA. As the court has noticed, the elements clause requires that the crime have as an element the use, threatened use, or attempted use of force. We have to satisfy that. That's prong one. We're into that door, right, under aggravated assault. But then there's, for juvenile offenses, an additional layer of protection that it also must involve firearm use. And that Congress has this two-tier inquiry, and for the one says has as an element, and for the second says an act involving. You know, Congress knows how to use the same words. If it wanted the act involving to be an elements clause analysis, it could have just also repeated, and for a juvenile offense, the crime must have as an element. But Congress chose broader language of an act involving. So given that different language, there's, you know, a canon of statutory interpretation that when Congress chooses different language, that choice has meaning.
If act of juvenile delinquency, though, is the term of art that Congress uses for a conviction, does your argument have less weight if that is in fact true?
We still have the difference between has as an element and the broader term of involving. And involving is more of a conduct-based term. Even Shuler, some of the language in Shuler indicates that Congress might have used that word involving as a choice to explain that it wasn't looking for formal elements. So Burge, because it's decided under a different provision, and it, you know, in order for an intervening Supreme Court to have overruled this court's prior precedent, the intervening Supreme Court decision has to be clearly on point. Well, DeCamps is not clearly on point. Mathis is not clearly on point. Shuler is not clearly on point. This court remains bound by Burge. And so, you know, this court might say, you know, given all these subsequent developments in the law, we don't like Burge anymore, but Burge still controls, and this court is bound to follow it. So that aggravated.
Let me ask you a question about Beamon. So assume this is a step two Beamon case, which is what you've been talking about. On step one of Beamon, we've said you look at, as a matter of historical fact, what happened in front of a district court judge to see which clause applied. On step two of Beamon, should we be looking at the law at the time of sentencing, or should we be looking at the law today? It seems, that's a question because it seems kind of incongruous to me to say on step one of Beamon, we're looking at what happened at sentencing, and then to step two, we just fast forward to whenever the issue happens to be litigated. But what would your position be on that?
Because we're looking, the whole question under Beamon is, did Johnson error occur at the defendant's original sentencing? Step two of Beamon also should look, historically, were there three convictions that could have qualified? And Beamon talks in the past, right? It doesn't say that now qualify, it says that could have qualified. Tribune also talked in the past, three convictions that could have qualified. So I think we're looking back, not to the post-DeCamps or post-Mathis landscape, but under the landscape that the defendant was sentenced, would this conviction have counted? That should be a historical inquiry. Now, if we also think about current law, and we know under current law, it also would count, which I think is still true today, given that Burge is controlling, you know, then it's not necessary to say, you know, if we know it counts under current law.
So Tribune is our best guess about how this all plays out, right? At least with regard to step two, with regard to Judge Brasher's question. What kind of cases did we cite in Tribune? Did we rely on cases only at the time or prior to? the sentence as a historical fact, or did we look to cases afterwards?
Your Honor, I am not sure. I'd have to go back.
So I'm looking at Tribune right now, and we cited in Tribune a 2014 case for the proposition that that particular type of drug conviction was a serious drug offense, which was after all, which was not historically, which is ahistorical for what it is. In other words, we seem to cite cases after the determination would have been made under the could have prong. And Beeman, and just look, going back to Beeman, Beeman only talked about historical fact with regard to step one, right? Not with regard to step two.
Well, Beeman, when it was setting forth the analysis, it talked in the past tense of convictions that could have qualified. And I think that makes sense given, you know, the question of a Johnson claim really shouldn't be a backdoor way of raising a Mathis or DeCamps claim. And so if we know that what we really need to look for is a Johnson claim, that should be a question of historical fact of what were the convictions that would have qualified back then. If we let this play out back then and the defendant had objected at the time of his 2003 sentencing, then, you know, the United States could have substituted in the aggravated assault and there would have been no question about divisibility, which didn't happen for, you know, decades. So I see my time has expired. We would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Yard?
Government could not have substituted the aggravated assault in 2003 because the historical case law includes two cases that were relevant at that time, Fulford from 2001 and Richardson from 2003. Fulford was an 11th Circuit decision that held that Florida aggravated assault with a deadly weapon does not require proof of use or carry of a firearm as an element of a crime and that it was it would have been improper to consult the charging paper to make that finding. The other opinion, the only one on point at that time for the juvenile ACCA provision in 2003 at the time of Mr. Anderson's sentencing was Richardson out of the Third Circuit. It was the first case on the issue and it held that Taylor demands a strict adherence to the categorical approach for juvenile offenses. If this court would have looked to see how it would have applied the juvenile provision back in 2003, what it would have found is Richardson and Taylor, and it would have seen that there's no way that in 2003, without Burge, the ag assault could have counted. Burge is abrogated by DeComp, Shuler, and Mathis because those opinions clarify to the point of abrogation that you cannot use the modified categorical approach when the statute is indivisible. So lest there be any question about what Burge says, those opinions make clear that you do not reach the documents for an indivisible statute. Shuler told us that involving does not bring in a factual approach. Involving demands an elements-based approach. This court has analyzed other statutes whenever they do bring in a factual approach and found that in Moncrief, in which brought in a factual approach, other cases have brought it in. This involving does not. Further, there is no doubt that this court, if it followed what the government suggests, will be the first court to find that ACCA demands a fact-based inquiry. There is no other circuit that has held that ACCA demands a fact-based inquiry for anything, a drug offense or a violent felony. And 30 years of Supreme Court precedent make clear that facts are irrelevant to ACCA because ACCA is an elements-based inquiry to be complicit with constitutional requirements.
Counsel, Fulford was a three strikes case, right, under 3559?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, it wasn't an ACCA case, right?
It was not, although the elements analysis of the Florida aggravated assault statute should have been exactly the same by this court.
Okay. I just wanted to make clear, it wasn't an ACCA case, though.
It was not.
Okay.
I see my time is up. I would ask that you find that the Beeman burden has been satisfied, or if not, remand to the district court for findings under Beeman for the reasons suggested by Judge Locke. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yard. We appreciate the presentation from both counsel.